From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, it's called the Earth Keepers. But here's what's happening. President Barack Obama says the United States has concluded that indeed Syria and that government carried out a chemical weapons attack near Damascus. He said the use of chemical weapons affected U.S. national interests, and sending a shot across the bows could have had a positive impact on the Syrian war. But in an interview with PBS, he said he had not yet made a decision about whether to intervene militarily. Let's check in with Jerome Corsi, who writes, of course, for WND and noted researcher and author as well. Jerry, I still think that they're going to go in and probably within the next day or two.
Well, George, the White House plans to do a strike on Syria, and they're moving forces in place right now, the military in Cyprus and around the region in the Middle East, in order to launch a strike, a cruise missile strike, and probably a fighter jet strike. But I think the tide of public opinion is turning against Obama. The president is having much more difficulty convincing England, for instance, tonight. Cameron's got second thoughts. And I think even within the United States, you're seeing a substantial determination by Congress that the president must come to Congress and make the case, or Congress could say he's acting unconstitutionally.
Now, is Cameron having second thoughts because he's not sure Syria, the government, was involved in that gassing?
Well, you know, George, the problem is we still have not seen the evidence. President Obama now has released that there was evidently a tap or an intercept that where there's some communication that the government was involved, and evidently a rogue commander using a sarin gas attack. That all sounds very suspicious to any of us who lived through the Tonkin Gulf incident that led to the Vietnam War. It turned out to be a phony, bogus incident that never really happened the way it was presented. If President Obama wants to make this case, he's going to have to present that evidence to the Court of World Opinion, to the UN, or some other international group. And until he does, that information is going to remain suspect when we've already proven that the Syrian rebels have at least also used gas attacks, and the UN confirms that.
All right, Jerry, we're going to check in with you later on this week, what's left of the week. One of the largest wildfires in California's history has triggered a smoke plume so big it has worsened air quality more than 100 miles away in Nevada. The smoky haze from the Rim Fire, which has raged now for 12 days in the area of the Yosemite National Park, sparked emergency warnings in the Reno and Carson City area. School children were kept inside for the second time in a week. People went to hospitals complaining of eye and throat irritation, and officials urged people to avoid all physical activity outdoors. The primary cause for hundreds of recent dolphin deaths along the East Coast is likely a virus, and there's no way to stop its spread right now. The virus is similar to measles in humans or canine distemper in dogs, according to NOAA. The five affected states are New York, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. North Carolina has also seen an increase in dolphin strandings. As of Sunday, there have been 488 dolphin strandings from New York to North Carolina, more than 300 dolphins above the annual average there. The anniversary of Martin Luther King and his very infamous I Have a Dream speech.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
Hard to believe. It took place 50 years ago. Wow, where does time go? Drivers in Washington, D.C. are more than twice as likely to get into traffic accidents than the national average, according to a new report, making residents of the nation's capital the worst drivers in the country, according to the study. Baltimore in second, the safest area, the best motorists, they say, Fort Collins, Colorado. Eating lots of broccoli may slow down and even prevent osteoarthritis. Tests on cells and mice show that broccoli compound, which humans can also get from Brussels sprouts and cabbage, blocked a key destructive enzyme that damages cartilage. Hollywood megastar Harrison Ford has arrived in Bulgaria to join the cast of The Expendables 3, which is being filmed in the Black Sea city of Varna. The actor joined the cast in the last minute after Sylvester Stallone, the producer and top character in the motion picture, threw out Bruce Willis because of the latter apparently asking for too much money. Some confirmed stars include Dolph Lundgren, Wesley Snipes, Mel Gibson, Antonio Banderas, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and, of course, our buddy Robert Davi, who has come back from that area. Robert, you're in a great movie here.
Yeah. I'll be going to Bulgaria in October.
You're looking forward to this? Expendables 3, it's going to be fun, isn't it?
Oh, it's going to be a kick with all those guys. You know, I mean, I know them for years, and it's going to be a lot of fun. I've done a film with Arnold before, not with Sly, although I was supposed to do Rambo 2 with him. And never with Harrison, but I've done stuff with Dolph, and it's going to be, I think it's, you know, they've got Kellan Lutz also from Twilight, and they got the girl that's the WME, one of those championship fighters, I forget her name, Ronda Rousey or something.
Yeah.
And Couture, I mean, just huge following of people, but it's going to be a blast.
Well, that's good. And what role are you playing, Robert, on this one? You going to be a tough guy again?
Mel Gibson, of course. Well, Mel Gibson and I are in cahoots, so I can't say more than that.
Okay, and you're going to be devoting your time Friday night. You're going to be in East Meadow, New York. You're putting on a free concert. You sing Sinatra songs better than just about anybody around right now. It's a free concert. People want more information. Where do they go for it?
Well, it's Ed Mangano, who's the county executive of Nassau, does these concerts. Last week they had Huey Lewis in the news, and great cultural events for the city of Hempstead and East Meadow at Eisenhower Park. It's 7 o'clock on Friday night, August 30th, at the Harry Chapin Theater, and they bring their chairs and their wine and taste lounges or whatever they want to bring. They had 20,000 people last week, but it's a huge event, and Long Island is my home turf, George, and it's
That's
exciting
right.
to be back home. And I first saw Sinatra in an outdoor concert on Long Island in Forest Hills.
I love both.
You know, so it's kind of like it's very exciting for me. Got a great band, 15-piece orchestra, and a great comedian, Mike Marino, who's opening. And of course, after the concert, because it's free, they make a collection for the hurricane victims of Long Island there.
Well, good for you. I know you spend a lot of time out that way. And you do a lot. It's a free concert, folks. You need more information. You live out there. Robert Davi's website is DaviSingsSinatra.com. D-A-V-I, by the way. DaviSingsSinatra.com. Robert, thanks. Lots of things going on in space, by the way. We may all be Martians. Evidence building that Earth's life originated on Mars and was brought to this planet aboard a meteorite, something we've talked about for years. This according now to a biochemist. His name is Steven Benner, and he's of the Westheimer Institute for Science and Technology, and that's in Florida. And China said it will launch its first unmanned lunar lander by the end of this year, complete with radio-controlled rovers to transmit images and dig into the moon's surface to test samples. Robert Zimmerman, space historian. Bob, it is a shame that we are not going back there.
At the moment, we can't put our own astronauts into space, George. So going to the moon is even, it's like that's the next step. First, you got to get humans into space. China's got a very detailed plan here, and they've been following very closely. They've had two lunar orbiters. They've mapped the surface in detail so they know where they want to land. They're going to do this rover lander this year. And then they're going to follow it up in 2 or 3 years with a sample return, unmanned sample return, and then they'll follow it up, they say, in the 20s with a manned mission to the moon. And they are doing both programs aggressively, though at a somewhat leisurely place, but still aggressively. It's very possible they'll be collecting souvenirs at an Apollo landing site in a few more years.
Is it an act of war if they pull our flag out of the lunar surface?
Well, since the Apollo 11 flag has been lying on the ground since they left in July of 1969, they wouldn't have to pull it out. They could just pick it up. In fact, they probably won't do anything to it because they'll take a picture of the American flag lying on the ground. Then they'll put their own flag up at that point, you know. It's embarrassing and very frustrating for an American, especially someone like me who's grew up watching us do this almost now, 45-plus years ago, that we are unable to do anything at the moment.
And how's Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, going for you?
It's booming. It's booming. It's available in ebook right now, and people are buying it up. It's really cool. You know, that was when we did it. You know, we went to the moon in 68, won the space race, and we did it. Those astronauts went knowing they were going to die. They had a 50% chance of dying, and they were willing to do it. And now we seem afraid. It's very sad.
Yeah, it sure is. Robert, thanks so much for being on the program. Hey, think about going to Mars. The application deadline for a one-way mission to Mars is almost here. Now, while the prospect is putting a lot of people off one way, it's also the dream of a lifetime to some others. More than 165,000 people have applied to join the manned Martian colony effort envisioned by the not-for-profit Mars One Foundation. But the foundation is only accepting applications until August 31st. One person who has applied will be our guest next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Ken Johnston learned to fly in the U.S. Marine Corps and was one of the five test pilots assigned to work with astronauts during the Apollo moon program at NASA in Houston. His job was to help train those astronauts to fly the lunar module. He was one of the test conductors, became a test director. Ken is a major in the Civil Air Patrol and is a Group 800 commander of the New Mexico Wing. He wants to go to Mars. He's one of the applicants to become an astronaut for the Mars One group that does want to send the first astronauts to Mars in 2022. Should I say buy now, Ken?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The 165,000 people, how do you get to the top of the list?
Well, I don't know. A lot of it has to be with on the website where people go and they vote. Now, it gives them an opportunity to listen to the various one-minute videos that we had to put up and read our introductions. And if they like us, then they give us anywhere from 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 stars. So I think that has a little bit to do with it. But there's a lot more going into it with our resumes and the selection committee.
On one hand, Ken, it's very exciting. On the other hand, it's kind of scary, isn't it?
Well, yes, it would be. For those of us who make the decision that we know it's a one-way trip, but then look what Christopher Columbus and the earlier adventurers that went out, sailed out. They were, people said they were going to fall off the edge of the world, and they didn't.
Absolutely. So tell me, how would this work, Ken? People will go to Mars, stay in pods or something, and what happens?
Well, according to the timeline that Bassel Anzorov and the others have put together, right now we're in the phase of selecting the astronauts that would be going. In 2015, we'll start doing the training. 2016, get all the communication systems all set up. And then come 2018, we're going to send a very large rover vehicle up there with mechanical arms and scoops and devices, and it'll be going to the various, looking for the smoothest place best to set up the housing, the pods, as you want to call them, and it'll have that. They're going to be sending in 2020, I'd say, the cargo, about 6 missions, so unmanned, to set up the deal, so that when 2022 comes around and the first crew of 4 goes, we're going to have a complete livable dwelling there. Actually going to have between about, for us Americans, it would be like a 10 by 20 living area just for each one of us. So it's not going to be too bad.
How often will you be able to roam around the Martian countryside?
Well, the things I've read, there were being prepared that probably two to three times a week that we'd go out and do research and development. We'd also have building additional habitats, getting it ready for the next crew, because every 2 years they'll be sending a new crew of 4, and as that keeps going along, they're going to be 6 teams of 4 each, and as I understand, the teams are going to be 2 women and 2 men, and that's as it grows, and we'll actually have a little colony going, and we probably have to make up our own rules and laws and the way it goes, and we'll all be Martians.
I guess the one downside of this, Ken, is you know, unlike being a colonist here on good old planet Earth, you walk out anytime you want. You can breathe the air. You're restricted on Mars. Are we going to be able to terraform it and maybe get an atmosphere?
Well, terraforming is a good long ways in the future, but that's is a plan of some of the scientists. And we need to get there and find out if there is any current type of life forms, as well as was there in the past. And from that information, they'll have a better idea as to the kind of approach they might want to take. But then you have to understand, Mars is a little bit further away from the sun than the Earth is, so it doesn't have as much heat.
Ken, let's assume you're on the planet for 10 years, and they've developed the technology to start returning back to planet Earth. Would you go back?
Well, it would all depend. Depend on if I have anybody left back on the planet, on Earth, and what kind of condition to be in. That living in one-third, basically, it was 1.38 of Earth's gravity. And because we were talking about a 6 to 7 month journey to return back to Earth. So depends on a lot of things as to whether or not I'd want to come back. The way I'm looking at it, even though I've got ancestors that lived over 100 years, I'd be 80 when I land. And if you spend 20 years there, I'd be celebrating my 100th birthday on Mars.
Well, Ken, you know, you've been a guest of ours over the years. And one of the major things you've talked about before is, of course, some of the things about the backside of the moon.
Right.
Kind of refresh us a little bit.
Well, on the Apollo 14 flight, when
Edgar Mitchell's, right?
I'm sorry?
That was Edgar Mitchell's flight.
That's correct.
Wasn't it?
Now, while they were on the surface, the command module pilot was taking film strips of the backside all around the moon so we could actually document it and make our maps better. Now, Dr. Thornton Page, who was the chief scientist for the astronomy department for NASA, asked me to pull out a particular reel of film, which was taken on by the Apollo 14 crew, and have a private showing. Since and this was set up with a what we call a gun sequence camera, like the military uses on their aircraft that takes pictures of where their shots were going,
right?
See what was going on. And since I had experience in the military running one of those, and I was in charge of the data and photo control department, Dr. Page asked me to bring it and set it up. And there were like seven other scientists, astronomers that were there. And while we're going along this particular reel on the backside, approaching a crater like Tsiolkovsky, as we got in, the sun angle was such that about half of the crater was in shadow and the other half was in light. And there in the shadow part was like five domes that you could see light shining through. And Dr. Page had me stop and freeze and zoom in and zoom out and freeze. And he turned to the other guy and said, "Well, boys, what do you think of that?" And they all just sort of chuckled and laughed like it was an inside joke. And he had me then just continue on and finish the reel. I had to check it back into the main photo department, where you had to have a top secret clearance to get into the back where we stored the things. And the interesting thing, as I was going back, there was a light table, which was about like a 3 foot by 3 foot, and there were three people sitting around it, one lady, which I think you've had on before, I can't remember her name right now, and two guys, and they were using brushes and painting out surface things on the negatives and positive transparencies. They were on the moon, and I asked them what they were doing, and one of the guys said, "Well, we're professional strippers," and the lady says, "Well, no, actually, what we're doing is we're stripping out any lights and things on the next to the edge of the moon, because we didn't want to confuse people seeing stars and thinking things were there." Well, that was interesting, and I'd seen other places where they had airbrushed things out.
Right.
But the real kicker was the next day, when I was supposed to show that picture, that reel, to the rank and file of NASA. And I had my brother and a few of the others that were scientists there watching it. And I said, "Take a look at this." And as we approached the crater, we go right over it, and there's nothing there.
It's gone.
I mean, it had been taken out. I stopped it, pulled the film out, checked the film. It hadn't been spliced, so they actually had to have refilmed it and put it back in overnight. And that afternoon, I ran into Dr. Page over at the Lunar Research Laboratory, and I said, "Dr. Page, what happened to the stuff that's on the backside of the moon?" He looked at me with his one eye, and he gave a good little wink with it and says, "There was never anything there."
Oh.
So I kept that secret until 1995, when I ran into Richard Hoagland, and I told the story to him and showed him the pictures that I had that I'd saved from the Apollo program. And just one thing after another, next thing you know, he's got me telling the story, and I step forward and I, you know, tell the truth. If you tell the truth, you don't have to worry about what kind of story you told.
That's absolutely true, Kim. What do you think those structures were?
I think they were habitats, dome-type habitats, down inside that crater.
Habitats, though, created by whom?
Well, that is always the question. Is it us and prior civilizations?
Uh-huh.
Is it E.T.? Those questions can't be answered until we go there.
Or is it us now?
Oh, that is also a possibility, I would think.
Hold on, Ken. We're going to come back, talk more about your trip to Mars and some other things. And next hour, of course, with you, we'll take phone calls. Ken Johnston with us. He wants to go to Mars. He just may. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Ken Johnston with us. He wants to go to Mars. Ken, how do you get selected?
Well, there's a four-step, four rounds of selection. The first one, of course, ends in 3 days on August 31st, and that was where we get alerted and people fill out an application and make a one-minute video describing themselves and why they think they should be selected. And then the second phase is the selection committee is going to go through and then pick out those that they'd like to have each country go through and boil it down to only 20 to 40 candidates. And then the third phase, the countries themselves along will be selecting out of their 20 to 40 candidates, they'll pick one from each country. The final selection then would be the committee would select a few additional ones, and they'd boil it down to six teams of four each. Those would be the ones that go into training for about 6 or about 7 years in preparation for the flight to Mars.
Amazing. Now, do you have to pay anything to go?
No. Actually, though, the application fee was $38 U.S. dollars, and it was based upon the GDP for the various countries that people have applied for the almost, I understand today, that's almost over 200 applicants. So there's basically $38 a piece for all of us, and that's to handle the people that are processing the videos as well as the all of the resumes and information. So it's kind of understandable, but that winds up a pretty good chunk of change, around $7 million plus or something.
Well, that's a lot of money right now. That's yeah, amazing.
Sure is.
Okay, by 2022, when they think they're going to go to Mars, how old will you be?
Let's see, 2022, I'll be right at 80 years old.
Kenny.
Now you got to remember, John Glenn.
John Glenn.
First time he went up in space, he was 41. And the second time he went up, he was 77. So, in fact, matter of fact, he really set some records to show that, you know, it's not based upon your chronological age. It's based upon your condition. And with the genes I have, I feel like I'm just getting started, and I'll be ready to go.
So you think even at 80, you're competitive enough to go?
I'm going to have to prove it.
Yeah, I guess you will. That is something else. Okay, so where are you going to land? Have they picked a spot yet?
Well, now, I've read quite a few research papers, real interesting, and they're looking, wherever they land, it's going to have to be certain from the Mars Global Surveyor that there is frozen water under the regolith of the soil on Mars, and because that's going to be absolutely
critical.
Necessary. And the various places they've looked at have one positive or another positive. And interesting enough, I think, is that one place that has everything they need, both hills and everything else, happens to be in Cydonia.
You got to bring Hoagland with you.
I know he would love to go. He and I have talked about it a little bit, and it's real interesting. I've even talked to the state commander in the SOLARTO, and he was a fighter pilot back during Vietnam. And I asked him, I said, if you had the opportunity to go, would you go? And he said, in a heartbeat.
That'd be funny, you and Richard on Mars. Okay, Richard, if Richard's listening, Richard, you leave Dr. Robin Falco behind, and you go to Mars with Ken. And
there you go.
Off you go.
Absolutely.
Well, that would be intriguing as well, especially if you're at Cydonia. At least you can get an upfront view of what the heck that is.
Well, one of the things I think that's going for me, and particularly, and that's why I really want to get with you and talk to the people that know of my background, is that you're going to know that I'm going to tell you exactly what we find and what we see. I'm not going to hide it like we've seen done in many, many cases before. So,
well, you're a whistleblower, aren't you?
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't usually go on and look up myself, and the person said, you need to check this out. And I went on and did Google on my name, and up pops, my old nemesis. help me out here, will you? What's his name? The guy.
Give me a hint.
James Olberg.
Okay, all right.
He always pops up again.
Okay.
And starts chipping away at my credentials and my background and claims, well, you know, he never was. He and I used to sit in the same room talking stories about his his master's thesis, which was mass media indoctrination and having to do with space and all. But for some reason, he's the hatchet man. He tries to do a number on me, but I just sort of blow it off and don't pay any attention to it because the people themselves can filter through and find out where the truth is.
Let's talk a little bit more about what's going on the moon and that far side. You know, Ingo Swann, the late remote viewer, in his book Penetration, wrote about objects and structures on the far side of the moon as well. This is very strange that you saw these pictures.
True. I don't know if I'm still with you now.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Sorry. There are a lot of people, you know, when you've got things that have gone digital. Back in the days when we first got those, we didn't have digital cameras. We didn't have anything. We were doing strictly analog. And we had thousands of people that were going through all of the pictures and things and finding strange things, finding towers, finding step-type pyramids. There are all kinds of structures that they can find which don't appear to be anything naturally geological. And then on the backside, there seems to be even a larger quantity of these mysterious objects. And I've looked at a lot of them that have come up since back in the early days, 95-plus years. So, I mean, 1995, so... we need to go. We need to go back there and find out our roots. We need to go to Mars and confirm that the asteroids and the possible life forms that came here to our planet may well have come from Mars. So maybe the Martians returning home.
Well, you know, we just had that story that a scientist believes life formed on this planet because of a meteorite from Mars that had life on it. So
that's
who
right.
knows? We might have been seeded that way. I have always suspected, Ken, though, that our civilizations are much older than mainstream science reports, and that it's possible that we had civilizations millions and millions of years ago who had the kind of technology to go to the moon, and maybe those structures are indeed from us.
I fully agree. Native Americans, as well as, I particularly like the translations that Zachariah Sitchin did of the ancient Sumerian clay tablets,
yep.
because that just lays it out very clear. And there's another South African that's written a couple of books.
Michael Tellinger, had him on.
Absolutely. And there's so much evidence that people just don't want to look at. And most people are so busy chasing taillights to and from work every day, they don't get out and research and find out for themselves. So we need to get it public and let everybody get a better understanding of who we are, what we are, and where we came from.
The Mars One project, once it gets up and running, how does it get funded? Is it going to be all private or what?
This is going to be entirely private. Bas Lansrop and Aaron Velders, I think they're the founders. It is a 501c3 type nonprofit organization, and the funding, if you take a look at the funding plan, when you look at how big football and all of the rights to publish,
sure.
site everything, that money was just going to come roaring in. And the fact, if you look at it, if the governments are involved, in fact, the closest thing NASA can talk about is, well, it would be around 2035, and it probably cost around $150 billion. Well, the analysis that have been done for Mars One is that it can be done one way for about $6 billion. And I know for sure there are a few multi-billionaires out there that might go down in history like to fund some of that. But in addition, think in terms of once we get on Mars, this is going to be a reality-type program in the selecting of the candidates, which ones are going to go, which team's going to go, who's going to be the first one. This is going to be done on live TV worldwide. And so you're going to have advertisement, and that's going to be the source of a bulk of the money for the program.
Mm-hmm.
And then who's going to say once you get on Mars, a company might want to name the landing vehicle, such as a Microsoft Lander or something like that. They're going to pay big money for those things. And that's the starting fund. It's going to be privately funded.
I wonder if they can get some funds on Kickstarter. Kickstarter has been pretty good for generating some revenue for people who are starting projects.
I'm certain that I'm just an applicant at this point, so I'm not really involved in that. But I've read enough to know that they are very actively checking on that. In fact, they've already got commitments from the various major aerospace companies including SpaceX. It has already made two civilian launches and rendezvous with the ISS, International Space Station, for resupply. And they're already talking about their Double X rocket, which would be capable of sending a whole crew all the way to Mars.
Ken, the fact that private companies are working on trying to go to Mars, does that mean that NASA will not go?
Oh, wow, that's a hard one. You never know what the government is going to do. When we had the directive from Kennedy to go to the moon and return safely within this decade, then the government was willing to fund it and it could go. Well, if it looks like we're going to do this publicly, and space is starting to become more friendly to private companies, they may well, depends on who's in the White House. I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, let's say 2016, the whole game could change, right?
It really could. And that's one of the concerns that you have with the government. It's so wishy-washy about funding. And, you know, once we landed on the moon, they started cutting budgets here and there. And we're going to have a colony on Mars, and there's going to have to be some resupply done until we can have sufficient agriculture inside domed areas and be self-sufficient, which we would become over a period of time with enough enough Martians, as we call them, humans from Earth, that the governments may turn around and if they cut the funds, we'd be in a lot of trouble. But fortunately, with this type of program where it's being funded publicly and it's advertisement and companies are getting royalties out of being able to track and follow their favorite Martian astronaut, we've got a long-term program going.
Let's talk about the trip, Ken. From the moment of launch to when you get to Mars, how long is that? A couple of years?
I don't know. A lot has to do with the location of where Mars is at the time. You know, Mars is the fourth planet out, you know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and then Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's in conjunction on the same side of the sun as the Earth, the distance between Earth and Mars is a lot shorter. So you'd be talking between 6 and 7 months.
Okay.
And that's why every 2 years we would be launching another crew of four. So that'd be when they come in conjunction. Yeah.
To add on to the crew that's already there.
Correct.
Okay. So what about, and I don't want to sound like doom and gloom, somebody dies on the way out there or something. What do you do?
Well, it's not going to be quite like Star Trek where they, you know, they just have a ceremony and push them out into space.
Yeah. Jettison them out there.
I'm certain that we would wind up having to keep the body in an ice-cold storage area within the spacecraft system. And then once we get to Mars, we'd hold a proper memorial, and they'd be the first person to be buried on Mars.
The first cemetery on Mars, huh?
Oh, that's another thought. Everything we will do from the moment we're launched will be a first for the human species. The first crew to be launched from Mars, the first one to go beyond the moon, the first people to orbit Mars, the first people to land on Mars. Every single thing we do is going to be that way.
But you're going to have huge limitations, though. I mean, I mean here, you know, if settlers come to the United States back in the 1800s or 1700s, they went out into the forest and they cut down trees and they started building houses. You can't do that on Mars.
Not for sure. We would have our habitat. We would be limited in that habitat. But then as we develop materials from the Martian surface and be either compressing into bricks and type things, we're also looking at the area to be possible lava tubes that might actually hold sufficient pressure to make them more living areas. So as time goes by, we will be expanding the colony living space. So it will grow. But the whole thing, you're not going to be able to go out, hold hands, and sit on a rock and watch the sunset, not without a spacesuit.
No, you're not going to be able to do that at all. So here's the big question then. Why even go to Mars? What's the purpose?
Well, man.
And I don't mean to explore. I mean, I'm all for that.
Right.
I'm all for going to Mars like we went to the moon, get back into your lunar module, get back into your ship, and come on back. But why go to the Mars and stay there?
The natural spirit of mankind is to explore and to advance. You said that. But if you look at what's going on in the world today and what may have happened a few times in the past, it'd be kind of nice to have a fallback place where the humanity will have made its first step into the cosmos and have a colony right there on Mars. And if people push the wrong buttons around here, it may be the only safe place to be.
But you're so dependent on Earth. I mean, what if something goes wrong? Technically, you're all gone.
No, that's actually, there have been some very interesting movies that have been put out about colonies started on Mars. In fact, that it was, I'll think of it in a minute. The thing is that the Earth stopped funding and stopped sending supplies, and they were became self-sufficient because of our domes and our own agriculture and our whole system, and that we wouldn't be dependent upon the Earth at all. And that would be the first step in stepping out. And some other people are looking at almost colonizing, but mining asteroids. Well, you're going to be cooped up and going to an asteroid and working on that. But Mars does have an atmosphere. It's about the same as being on top of Mount Everest. But the spacesuits wouldn't be near as cumbersome or bulky as what we've had to use during the Apollo program and the space shuttle.
That's true, too. How big do you think this colony could get?
How big can it get? I guess it just depends on how successful we are in the beginning, and how many people have enjoyed watching it and following it as we've been going on, and then they get the bug and they want to go. Initially, we're going to have the six crews of four, so you've got 24, and then by then we're hoping that we'd expect to have more. To the point where we would have tourists that would want to be making the trip. And by then, hopefully, we would have better propulsion-type systems that could cut down on the six-month delay. Because there are some hardships and problems that have to be faced by being in microgravity and stuff. But those have been addressed already.
Would you have any regrets going at all?
None at all. Actually, people ask me, what does your wife think? Well, she's actually the one that heard about it a little bit late because they made the announcement on 9 August. And I guess it was 2 weeks later that my wife told me about it. And I really had to jump through hoops to get my application in time. So, no, I wouldn't have any regrets. I told my grandfather that I put our name on the moon through Grumman, where I was their test pilot.
Right.
And I told him, I said, someday I want to put our name on Mars, and this just may be my opportunity.
So you would leave your wife behind?
Yes.
And what would that last face-to-face, what would you tell her?
Well, what would I tell her?
Didn't expect that one, huh?
I didn't expect. Well, first of all, I certainly would tell her that I love her. And the other one is that don't get too far from the phone, because we will be texting. We'll be communicating. That's one of the ways we're going to keep some of the stress down, is we'll be able to maintain the relationships with our friends and things through electronic media. The only problem is you have to get used to the delay and time between the distance.
Boy, Facebook will be a hot thing then, huh?
It's interesting enough, I'm sure if you text and at all, I send a text to my wife, and sometime it may be an hour before I get an answer back, and that's still communicating. Well, Mars, if it's in close conjunction to the Earth, it would take 2 minutes to get the signal from Mars to Earth, then you talk a bit, and 2 minutes for it to get back. If you're on the other side of the sun from the Earth, it could take 22 minutes one way.
That's amazing. The whole thing's amazing, though, Kenny. Look, I don't fault you for wanting to go. More power to you. I'm not sure I would, especially if it would happen to be a one-way trip.
That's the way it has to be done the first time. I think it will work really well. In fact, I think there'll be a time that some of us would even be able to make a return trip back to the Earth if we wanted to.
I think that would be key. If they could ever get to that point where they could say, look, we want you to colonize Mars, but we do have the capability of bringing you back if you want to come back. I think that would be more intriguing for a lot of people, don't you?
Well, I'm sure that it would be, and because Mars can wind up being a really fascinating place to go and visit. And it'd be nice to be the host colony that puts the people up when they come and visit. It's going to cost you, though.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, stay with us, Ken. We've got a final hour to go with you. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM.